what does the MVP of Streamline look like? What did it look like?
Yeah. the MVP, I would say, is like secondary to knowing that people will pay. If you're looking at building a company, right, there's like B2B companies and there's consumer. If you're building consumer, you build things, you see if they stick. For B2B, you can sell before you build, which ends up giving you higher conviction around what you're even building in the first place.
Welcome back to the Clean Techies podcast, where we interview the top climate tech founders and investors to share their stories, advice, and lessons when it comes to building and investing in climate. All right, everyone, we are back with another episode, and today we have someone who you may have heard of before. She and her team are working super hard on solving a problem that many, many companies building in climate need help solving. Our guest is none other than Helena Merk, the co-founder and CEO of Streamline Climate. The TLDR is they help companies identify which grants to apply for based on the probability of a positive outcome. And they also help with writing the grants to ensure everything is done correctly so that, you know, you don't accidentally get disqualified for using a period instead of a semicolon. We cover her journey and how growing up in Palo Alto had an impact on her career choices. She gives us a high-level summary of what it's like to apply for grants today and how they got their first customers and much, much more. I thoroughly enjoyed recording this episode, and I'm confident you'll enjoy listening. So without any further delay, enjoy the episode. All right. Welcome to the show. How's it going today?
Good. Super excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're excited to have you, obviously. There's been a lot of buzz around what you guys are doing for several months now, I think. I think ever since Climate Week, people have been talking. I've heard your name and your company come up a lot, so super excited. I guess before we get into it, can you just give us a quick summary of who you are and what it is that Streamline does?
Yeah, I'd love to. So I'm Helena. I'm the CEO and co-founder of Streamline. We help hardware and deep tech climate startups apply for government funding faster. And that involves helping them identify opportunities and apply to them. And we use software and AI to do a lot of that in an automated fashion.
Hey there. Are you building a climate tech business and looking for very specialized talent? Consider reaching out to our sponsors, NextWave Partners. NextWave are experts in talent acquisition, recruitment, and retention across the climate tech, renewables, and ESG spaces globally. So if your team is growing or you're looking to make a career change yourself, feel free to reach out to NextWave at next-wavepartners.com or reach out to one of their consultants directly via their LinkedIn page. Nice. Very concise answer. I like that. It's very good to be able to tell you what you're doing clearly. A lot of early stage companies can't do that. So I'm assuming you've learned that over the past months. But I guess before we kind of get into too much about the technology itself, can you tell us a little bit about grants and generally, like, why does it matter? How many companies really need access to these things? Can you just kind of give us a high level summary?
Yeah, I mean, grants encompasses a huge spectrum, as you're well aware. I think the first kind of surprising fact that we learned ourselves as we dove into the world of grants was it's not just something that tiny companies that don't have any money or revenue go after. You know, you have the bootstrap companies that go after it, but so do public companies. Like Tesla, for example, is going after grant after grant after grant. They have entire teams kind of going after government opportunities. Similar to a company like Rivian and a lot of other folks kind of in the EV and electrification space. But at the highest level, you know, it's government funding that's non-dilutive. So they don't own part of your company after they give you money. It does have different strings attached, right? There's no free money ever, even though some people like to call grants free money. And I think the biggest kind of critique of going after grant funding is often that it is slower and that you have to be kind of very prescriptive with what you're going to spend the funding on versus if you chose to raise funding through venture capital, should you have to pivot or kind of strategically shift, you know, VCs are your partners and they would very much understand that, like, you have to veer off of your roadmap or, you know, create a new roadmap.
Yeah. So basically there may be some instances where, because you have a grant funding, you're really tied to pursuing what you're doing. Can you talk more about that? Like how often, maybe you've seen examples of companies that you've worked with or that, like, hey, they really did need a pivot and there was opportunities to still do so, or is it really, really strict?
It's really, really strict. And I think the other thing that makes it challenging is that you're planning so far in the future, which isn't new to anybody who's doing something in the world of hardware. But, you know, the grant process takes so long that you're applying to get funding 6 months from now. And maybe within the timing of getting the, you know, go ahead that, hey, you've won this grant and starting the deployment, you've learned some things. And the better experiment or pilot might actually be slightly different than what you proposed. So now you have to kind of go back to the grant issuer and tell them, hey, I have a slightly new plan. Can I get this approved? And it just adds a lot of kind of administrative steps. That said, it's non-dilutive funding and like very much still worth it. It's just, it does add, you know, some of that administrative overhead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I think it's obviously quite valuable, and people talk about hardware being hard, but there's a lot of the funding things when it comes to grants. If you can get grants, right, you actually may not have as much dilution as you usually would think, right? Because traditionally, I mean, not, I shouldn't say traditionally, but at the beginning of the clean tech or the climate tech boom with hardware, they're like, oh, let's just raise equity for building these mm-hmm. projects. But maybe not always a great idea, as I think we've all learned over the past couple of years. But could you talk about how long does it actually take to apply in most cases? You said it takes a long time, but can you give us some examples of what that process usually looks like?
Yeah, I'd love to. So obviously there's a wide variety of grants, you know, the ones that like, you know, the hundreds of millions of dollar sized grants obviously take a lot longer than if you're going after like a SIBR, a small business innovation research grant. I'd say the SBIR grants are probably one of the easiest kind of opportunities to go after. And those will take around 100 hours of just purely applying once you have kind of the shape of what you're actually proposing outlined. It takes a lot longer if you still have to rope in partners. You never kind of want to apply to these opportunities alone. You definitely can, but it's so much stronger of like an, you know, an application package if you rope in like a community benefit organization or other partners that will collaborate with you. So there's like this BD element that is often overlooked if you're looking just at like the raw numbers of how long will it take me to type this out? Because you're kind of developing a proposal, right? Mm-hmm. The thing of it is really the thinking behind it.
Yeah, I can't, that would not be the job for me. I already get stressed out writing blog posts. Could you talk about, one thing I'm curious is that, you know, it takes a long time. But is that mainly because of the work that has to go into it, or is it just partially the nature of governments and these kind of sometimes probably philanthropic organizations that have a lot of bureaucracy? Is there any effort on the side of the issuer to make things move faster, to change how that's done?
As in, are they trying to?
I mean, like, are there proposals for like ways to make it more streamlined aside from the application process? No pun intended.
I mean, you know where the name of our company came from, which is great. I'd say there's efforts to make it better. Everyone I've talked to on the kind of the grant issuer side is very aware of the challenges. They just don't have the solutions, which is part of why we sort of have conversations kind of on both sides of like a marketplace, where hopefully, you know, we play a piece in helping accelerate the funding on both sides. Because to date, the only solution they've had is scaling up reviewers and scaling up support. There's this whole network of what are called technology assistance centers, where first-time applicants to like federal funding can basically get a free grant writer or assistance to apply. Which, if you think about it, is kind of saying, you know, the government is spending money to help people apply for grants.
Yeah.
That's just like, they obviously recognize there's a challenge, and their solution is just, rather than solving, you know, the underlying application process, is like, let's throw more like human power at it, which works, but it definitely doesn't scale. And if we're trying to accelerate the rate at which we get all this funding into climate, we need something that's scaling way faster than we could possibly kind of hire for.
Hey guys, sorry for the interruption. I just need a few seconds because Soma and I have two quick favors to ask. Putting out the show each week takes about 15 to 20 hours between us, so it's a lot of effort, and it would mean the world to us if you would leave a review and mention your favorite episode. Secondly, if you're not already, go over and subscribe to the podcast on Substack. The content is free, but if you like hanging out with us each week, maybe we're even the kind of guys you'd like to buy a coffee for on occasion, consider becoming a paid subscriber. For the cost of one lavender latte a month, you can help us immensely. Thank you for tuning in consistently and helping us to share our guests' stories. Now back to the show.
Yeah. I mean, this is not necessarily the intended scope of the conversation, but in your mind, you have any particular thoughts on ways it could be scaled where it's much more simple, where there's a certain kind of checkboxes that are ticked throughout the application process where it's verified by some third party automatically that maybe is already an existing third party. Some of these kind of tools to really make sure things move faster, or you can at least knock off the top 90% of applications because, hey, these are just nowhere close, and that way we can spend our time focusing on those. Do you have any ideas on how that could be streamlined on the other side, on the receiving side of it.
Totally. And I would say, like, we already do a bunch of that. So like a thing that we've been working on at Streamline is, if you're trying to apply to an opportunity, we run a series of eligibility checks. And if you don't qualify, we just tell you not to apply. I think, like, that's like, like, if we're looking at ways that we can save our company's time, it's telling them not to apply to opportunities where they have no chance of success. And that sounds weird, but it's probably the number one reason that companies get rejected from grants is because they either, you know, misformatted something, or they applied to something that was never meant for them. The only surefire way you'll know if you're a good fit is by, like, messaging or emailing the program managers. But there's a whole series of checks we can run in an automated fashion. And that same set of checks is something we could kind of offer on the kind of the grant issuer side. But ideally it doesn't come to that, right? Like, you shouldn't, like, labor over this application if it's going to take you 100 hours only to then get told, hey, you didn't meet this basic requirement. I'm sorry. Like,
try again. Yeah, that's actually really interesting. It just makes you think of, you only have, especially as a founder, you only have so many hours in a day, right? I'm assuming some of the clients are larger, but regardless, there's only so many resources, right? And you have to use them wisely. You don't want to be spending, like you said. So why don't we get into it then? So who are your customer types, right? What is the kind of archetype of what they look like? How big are they? What are they doing?
Yeah, so to date, we've worked with people who have an in-house expert on grants. So it's not the super early companies who want their hands held to be guided through the process. Eventually, you know, we want to support people across the board. But because we're relatively new, and we can't necessarily offer that level of support, we've built a self-service tool that companies use in-house. So typically they'd have like one grant writer, if not a full team, or somebody who's just like full-time writing grants as one of their many jobs. And we help that individual kind of 10x their effectiveness. And we think this is almost like the better approach than if we were to kind of offer everything full service, because like I was saying earlier, there's so many aspects to grant writing that go beyond like the mechanics of writing themselves. Like, you have to also have like a BD function. And if you don't have the bandwidth internally to bring in partners and then shape the proposal, that would be a lot on our end to take on for every client.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk more about what is that when you say BD function? Like, what does that look like?
Yeah. So if you're let's say you're an EV charging company and you want to install, you know, a whole set of EV chargers, and there's like a government opportunity that's like, hey, go install these chargers in these locations on the curb. For you to actually apply to that opportunity, you probably need a bunch of different partners that you're applying with together. And we can recommend people to you, but we can't have those conversations on your behalf. And that's kind of where that element comes in of like the company itself has to go and build those relationships and partnerships. And then we can, you know, make sure that all the boxes are checked and it's formatted correctly. And kind of like, I think, okay, the best analogy here might actually be LinkedIn, right? It's like LinkedIn can give you the set of tools to become this like massive networker, but it's not going to have the one-on-one conversations that are needed to actually build depth
Correct.
In that network.
Yeah. Okay. Got it. So there's always a larger team, which is, I guess, I think it's interesting to know that, because I think for a lot of early stage companies, they're maybe not familiar with what a grant team looks like, where they're like, oh, let me just spend this weekend applying for this thing. And then they probably quickly realize this is way harder than I thought.
I mean, all that to say, I don't mean to scare anyone away from grants. Like, a huge amount of grants are won by early stage companies. It's just go after kind of grants that are meant for that size. And you don't need to hire a grant writer. You don't need to use Streamline. Like, you can just hammer it out and you can probably win a grant.
Yeah. And I guess, so just to clarify then, what is the business model? Is it just purely a software kind of as a service model?
Yeah. So we have various like pricing tiers based on the volume of applications they're going after. But ideally it's just, you know, super simple annual plans.
So, and then the thing I'm always fascinated by building companies in general is when people actually start something, right? How do they get things going to get customers? So could you talk about what does the MVP of Streamline look like? What did it look like? At what point did you, you know, actually get somebody to start paying you?
Yeah. the MVP, I would say, is like secondary to knowing that people will pay. I think there's, if you're looking at building a company, right, there's like B2B companies, and then there's consumer. If you're building consumer, it's like a shot in the dark. You build things, you see if they stick. Maybe somebody has some kind of framework there, but I'm pretty sure that's still the name of the game. For B2B, you can sell before you build, which ends up giving you higher conviction around what you're even building in the first place. And what that looks like in practice is like having a bunch of conversations, understanding people's problems and what they're looking for, and building exactly for that. There's obviously a lot of ways of doing that. The approach that we took involved kind of recruiting design partners that we knew had very deep expertise in pursuing grants and winning them, in managing them once they've won awards. And we took time to shadow them and to kind of see what are their day-to-day workflows, which kind of take the most amount of time and are easiest to optimize. Sorry, easiest to automate. And we kind of like chart those out and look at it very much from like a software lens of like, cool, I can automate those like 20 clicks that you just took and reduce that 1 hour into like 10 seconds. And you do that enough times and suddenly like it's a very, you know, high ROI productivity tool because we take every single little workflow that you have and automate it. So we built that out with several design partners who were going after grants. And then we started, you know, showing this to people who were not a design partner and onboarded them as paying customers.
Mm-hmm. So then just to clarify, how do you go to the paying customer site? So you understood what they were doing. You probably had some method of tracking them. But am I correct in understanding? I'm not a technical person, so this might be a bad question, but is it an LLM that you had to build, that you had to train, like, okay, these things? Like, and if so, if that's the case, then how do you actually go about doing that? How many hours of kind of footage of other people doing work do you have to understand before you can do it accurately? Because that's always the issue with these AI solutions is like, is it accurate? Because if it's not accurate, you might as well throw it out the window.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, I'd say so much of what can be like optimized in the grant process doesn't even involve AI or LLMs. It's okay. Literally just building better software that lets people do what they're already doing faster. I'd say like the software stack for like a SaaS founder is entirely built out, right? You can incorporate your company through like Stripe Atlas. You can do payroll through Gusto or Rippling, right? There's a bunch of different companies that fill various administrative needs that make it so easy to start a company these days. But then you look at like the world of deep tech companies and they have nothing. There's no tooling that helps them 10x themselves. So what I'm saying here is like the bar feels really, really low to build something of high value because nobody's been building for these types of founders before. So like that's like the first step is just like build a product that makes their lives better. And even without any LLMs, I think we could 10x a lot of their workflows. Then you add the LLM component and it's like, okay, cool. This is an interesting feature. But I'd say at the core, you know, what we're building is like, you know, a workflow task management automation tool. And now with the world of LLMs, it becomes more powerful. So when looking at, you know, the actual building of this, the first was just like, let's build the product that helps manage all the workflow parts. And then we'll add LLM components and focus a lot on the UX to make sure that, you know, if there was ever some kind of hallucination, or discrepancy or challenge, we make it very obvious that like, hey, these are the things that we're uncertain about. This was generated. Do you approve? Do you continue? In like a very consent forward approach. So I think it comes down less to like the LLM itself and more, how do you design a product that's intuitive enough that you can trust? And I think trust ends up being a huge thing, especially, you know, with our kind of customers who are all like very IP sensitive, just by nature.
Hey guys. We need your help with something. In order to better understand what you like most about the show, what you dislike, and how we can help you, please take 7 minutes to fill out our listener survey if you haven't already. It only takes about 7 minutes, but it will drastically improve our ability to give you the best content that you're looking for. Thanks for your help. Now back to the show. Yeah, okay, that makes sense. One thing you said that I thought was quite interesting, and I don't think we've had the chance necessarily to ask somebody this question, is you said that nobody's really built software for these people, right? For this specific, at least, use case. And you said the bar is low. How do you kind of mentally guide your team and how you do things if that is the case? Because if the bar is low, it might be easy to say, oh, you know, it's good enough. Like, it's better than what there was. But you know, obviously there will be people following you to try to pursue what you're doing as well. So can you talk through how you navigate that?
Totally. I'd say it's like any other software development lifecycle, or how I always like to build product, which is like ship when you're uncomfortable. it's like, if you feel proud of your product, like you waited too long, and that works in software. That only works in software, probably not in anything that's like physical. but we try to get things out the door as soon as possible. The moment we think it'll provide more value than without having the tool. So that can mean a lot of things, right? If you're in building in a crowded space, the bar to providing additional value is higher, because you have to be better than the status quo. In our case, the status quo is spending hundreds of hours on grants.gov trying to find an opportunity. So even if our search doesn't cover every single opportunity in the world, it's better than the status quo, right? So that's like MVP level. Like I would say an MVP is better than the status quo. I feel blessed that our entire team is like all perfectionists and go-getters and just super hungry. So everyone's dissatisfied when we just launch an MVP and super motivated to kind of keep pushing that bar higher. So I think that gets to the second part of your question of how do you keep kind of upping the ante? And it's like, we know what good software looks like. We know what good product experiences are like. And that's what we're striving to and pushing at like 1,000 miles per hour to kind of get there.
Yeah, I think that's quite interesting. I mean, I don't know that you guys are the first, but they're the first I've heard of, right, in this space. So if you are the first in this space, usually there's a little bit of pressure, right? Because as soon as somebody identifies a new opportunity, like everybody comes chasing after, say, ooh, let me do that better. So I think it'll be really interesting to chat again in a couple of years and see where things are and how you continue to push, because it's probably easy with a small team. Everybody's motivated. You were there at the early days. And then as you get bigger, you're like, okay, well, now we've got customers. Like, then the maintenance idea comes in, right? And you're just like, okay, we got to maintain this machine we've built. We don't want it to fall apart. And then you still got to push yourself to innovate. So so I appreciate that. One question I have is, I don't know if you have specific stats on this or anything, but when you look at the global market opportunity for this, do you anticipate eventually going beyond just helping with grant writing? Is there a lot of other addressable markets for this?
Glad you asked. I mean, the way we look at what we're working on is it's kind of workflow automation around getting government funding into the climate and energy transition. Grants is like the tip of the iceberg there. What we've actually been spending more of our time on is going after RFPs. And I think very much like the type of government funding you're eligible for depends on, you know, the technology readiness level of the company, as well as the stage. Right. So if you're, you know, doing a lot of EV charging, you're most likely going after like government contracting or city level RFPs versus if you're doing something with, say, like, I don't know, green hydrogen or, you know, reimagining steel, you're earlier in that kind of TRL level and going after a different type of capital. If you're building large commercial facilities, maybe you're applying to the LPO. So there's all these different pathways for acquiring capital, all of which come in these like non-dilutive forms. And climate founders in particular have to kind of currently architect this like very diverse capital stack, which like at every stage, they're creating a new stack and like reimagining where they're going to get funding. And we think that there's, you know, room to build a large company that helps them navigate every single step of this process. And by starting with grants, we end up being really, really well positioned to grow into all those other stages of capital. The other thing we think a lot about is, you know, what additional services can we then start adding to this platform once we've helped a company go through all these stages? And that might be connecting them to private capital, to project financing. And we can do all of that because we've been able to track the company's progress, see how they're winning grants, and see what else they're eligible for. Somebody compared it to like a mint for climate tech companies, which feels, when I first heard it, I was like, oh, this is so reductionist. But it kind of landed decently well because it was like, you have this like one like kernel of data, right? And then you can kind of connect it to whatever other services you might need because you're able to, you know, serve with that data.
Yeah. Okay. I like that. Now, I think it's quite interesting. Something I guess I hadn't thought about until probably 6 or 7 months ago when I went to the ERA pitch day was there's a lot of these companies building in climate that are their technology will ultimately be super valuable to companies outside of the climate tech world, and their addressable market is going to be massive, right? They just starting with climate, obviously, which I think is interesting because it just goes to show that it kind of proves the idea that climate isn't really a sector, but you know, the climate technology is helping people with everything. So I think it's really fascinating when people start to think beyond just, hey, let me serve the companies in climate tech right now. So, okay, going back a bit, once you did those test projects, so I'm assuming it may not be that hard to find a partner who's like, hey, we will literally want to do some work for you for free. We want to follow you around and figure out what you're doing. There generally weren't too many hesitations, I assume, with people, right? That maybe you had to go through 10 or 20 people before somebody said, yeah, sure, you can shadow us. Is that correct?
It was surprising how much interest we got. I think that also helped us build conviction that, like, wow, this is a pain point. And part of how we like ended up choosing our partners was really just in, we had a lot of agency in deciding who did we want to work with based on their experience, but we'd had over 100 kind of user interviews and like conversations leading up to that point, and really just trying to understand what were the pain points and where should we start building. And, you know, easily proved ourselves within a few meetings that, you know, every meeting we'd have like weekly calls with our partners, and every meeting we'd come with like new designs and kind of new things for them to kind of tear apart and critique. And then we built those into prototypes and MVPs and kind of constantly kind of kept proving that, you know, we deserve their like 1 hour a week their busy lives.
Yeah. And then once you did that, what was the, do you have any, I guess, people talk a lot about scaling right now. So do you have any go-to-market wins or strategies that you used or tactics that you were like really, really helpful that you want to share with other people doing also building climate tech software?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say it depends on the type of climate tech software. For us, we end up serving like the entire ecosystem, which I love. I like love building community and like hosting things. So for us, we've hosted like events, both for SF Climate Week and then New York Climate Week, with people that were notable in the industry that like basically provided value for everybody. So if you're going to host an event, like make sure it's just value producing. I'm pretty tired of a bunch of happy hours, but anything kind of works. And for us, it worked really well because we hosted a panel with like people from the DOE and people who've won grants and had like a moderated panel. That's honestly been very effective at just like getting our brand out and then building up like a pretty decent wait list of people that we have yet to kind of give access to the product for, just because we're like bandwidth
constrained. Yeah, that's something that's what I had understood. I wasn't sure about that, but I understood a lot of people have been talking and trying to get access to the platform at some point. So it's obviously a win, right? When you have more demand than you can service initially. So that's helpful. And then just kind of quickly, I want to go back to what ended up getting you into climate? Like why did you decide to start building in climate? Because you had built, I believe, you were working on spirals prior to this, right?
Yeah. And before that, spent a few years working on a video chat company, which went through IC and got me kind of into the world of building startups. But I'd say climate has been like a constant in my life for a long time. I mean, grew up doing all sorts of outdoorsy things, which is, I think, a very common trend amongst people who work in climate. And the first kind of real project I was building back in high school was working with animal shelters and increasing kind of adoption rates through software for a lot of the volunteers. And that was fun. But I think the gap I really had was that I didn't feel like I could make an impact in like the software and climate intersection, and that the real impact was going to be boots on the ground. And I spent several years kind of going down the pre-veterinary track, thinking that, okay, this is the path to doing it, right? Like if I want to go work with nature and, you know, help with biodiversity, like the closest I could get with that, especially with like interest in like biology and anatomy, was like, you know, becoming a vet. So, you know, my dream at that time was like, I'm going to go be an elephant vet. And that was amazing. But like halfway through the program, I had this like existential crisis moment where I was like, I'm literally putting bandages on the problem. We were working with elephants who had their feet blown up by landmines. And we were treating their feet so they could walk again. And I was like, holy moly, like, we can't solve this at a system-wide level. Like, what I'm doing doesn't scale. And I think I can do something bigger at, like, a massive scale. Ended up dropping out, came back to the Bay, worked at a few startups, and just couldn't get kind of scale out of my head and the idea that software could be that level of scale. But I really just couldn't connect those dots for a while. But then after the video chat company, we ended up selling that to a competitor. I finally had some time to like take a step back and look at things from like a systems level. And what stood out in climate, when I finally had just like months to just like read and dive deep and talk to people, was really that there were like two like mega trends in barriers to scale, which was like policy and finance. And I like looked at those two options. I was like, okay, I'm not going to go into policy. That sounds awful. And here I am kind of at the intersection, but I was like, this is gonna be so slow. Like I will go crazy. And then finance was interesting. And we immediately started looking at carbon markets and how we could kind of build more trust in them, because it seemed like at the time, this was like early 2022, that, you know, carbon markets were at the time the most effective way of getting private capital into nature. But there was a lot of concern around trust and volatility of the markets, especially with the VCM. And we use blockchain to kind of enhance transparency there. Turns out there's a lot of other things wrong with carbon markets. Not wrong, just challenges that have to be overcome. And we decided after like the wave of policy that was passed, you know, in the favor of climate, which is like Bill, CHIPS, IRA, that the most effective way of unlocking capital for climate companies was actually to unlock, you know, the hundreds of billions of dollars that are kind of sitting behind a wall of paperwork. And every single climate person I was talking to was like, how do I get access to IRA money? Like, what do I do? And we just saw them spending hundreds of thousands of dollars each on consultants and on, you know, reading papers and papers and papers. And as a software person, that just like hurt my soul a little bit. I was like, we can optimize this. So we started kind of very targetedly experimenting in that space of how do we kind of automate a lot of these like policy-based decisions, and what else can we kind of do in that space?
Well, one thing that stands out to me, maybe it's just because of a very different, like, because you grew up in the West Coast, is that correct?
Yeah, in Palo Alto.
Do you, like, how did you get this idea kind of in your head about scale early on? Because, I mean, this is not something I would say a lot of people I grew up around in the Midwest don't think about this thing, right? So I'm just kind of curious what led you to always be thinking about that, even at a pretty young age.
I don't know. I mean, probably a combination of, like, influence of, you know, the people I was around. You know, we were like houses away from like Mark Zuckerberg or like Tim Cook, and my dad got one of the first iPhones. So there's obviously that like just background ambiance of like, you can build big things, you can change the world. And then also this like expectation that like I could slash would do something with my life. My parents, we moved here when I was a kid from Europe, and they kind of gave up a lot of things to give us the, you know, the lives that we had. And they are loving parents and awesome. And I love them to death, but they definitely kind of had this like element of our children will do amazing things. And that definitely was very motivating. And it was like, yeah, one thread, the environment I grew up in, and then also just having access to like tinkering on stuff. My dad definitely pushed me to like try building an app for his iPhone. That was like the deal we made. It's like, I wanted to play with his iPhone. And he said, if you build an app for it. And I was like, okay, I'm going to do that. And I don't know if he knew I would actually take him up on it. But that got me into app development when I was way too young, like early, like in grade school. And started building apps, and then got decent at it. And some of them made it, and I bought myself an iPad, and then got even more serious about app development. And then throughout high school started working at, you know, more serious companies, like this cloud security company I spent my senior year working at. So there is like, I think just enough exposure that like something big was possible. And then when everything aligned, it was like, cool, not only is something big possible, like anyone can do it. You just have to like really want it. So yeah, we're trying.
I love it. I just think it's really fascinating because it's so different compared to the kind of the place and the environment I grew up in. And I think it just makes me think, we talked a little bit about this with Susan Sue at one point from Toba Capital about the getting people exposure and access to the kind of the mindset of Silicon Valley, right? Because it shouldn't be just limited to that area. There's probably many, many capable people who, if they were inspired at a young age, could be doing other things, right? So I really find it fascinating. It might be usual to you, but it's not usual, I don't think, for the most of the country, right? Maybe the more techy places like Silicon Valley and New York, for example. But I appreciate that. I appreciate the insight. What was the biggest lesson that you learned from building Spirals, like on the company side, not about the carbon market specifically, but like building the company?
So I should clarify that Spirals is, as like a legal entity, the same company as Streamline.
Oh, okay.
So I did just a hard pivot. So learned a lot about company building, and I continue to learn a lot. I feel like every day is a learning experience in the most awesome way. I'd say I had bigger learnings in Glimpse, which was just like a longer experience. And I think one of those was the biggest learnings were mostly internal about who I am and like what I want to do in the world. And Glimpse was working in video chat during the peak of the pandemic, and things were working well and it was growing. And that's such a thrill. You know, if you've ever built something that people are like pulling out of your hands, like, that's wonderful. You feel like you're creating value and you make people happy and you're solving a problem. And I think that kept me going for a long time. And at some point I kind of realized, actually, this isn't what I want to spend my life working on. And I'm glad people are getting value from it and we're getting a lot of good feedback and revenue's growing, but it wasn't like value aligned with where I wanted to be and who I wanted to be in the world. So the biggest learning from that experience was really, I need to work on something that is both solving a problem and people want, but also one that is just like so fundamentally aligned with who I am as a person and where I want to be. So recovering from Glimpse was really just like this kind of soul searching existential journey almost. And I think that's something that is definitely going to vary founder to founder. It's like, I think the term people use is like, are you like a missionary founder or a mercenary founder? And mercenary founders are just like, they'll be opportunistic. They'll go after things and just like build good businesses, hopefully, right? That like that IPO or whatever. And then there's missionary founders who build from like passion and will kind of do whatever it takes to like build something out that wants to change the world. And, you know, maybe they're ruthless in a different way, I'd say. But I think I definitely learned that, you know, I can't just build a business that makes money. That's like never going to be fulfilling for me. And it's going to lead to burnout.
Yeah, I think it's quite fascinating. Understanding, it's not really what we focused on this podcast, but it's one of my favorite things to listen to other people's podcasts about is how founders learn things like about themselves through building companies and just entrepreneurs, right? It's like usually if somebody's crazy enough to become an entrepreneur, they've got something they got to work out deep down, right? Anyways, right?
So yeah.
it's always yeah, it's pretty fascinating. Okay, very cool. One thing I'm really always curious about is on the talent side is how did you find your co-founder and know that, hey, like this is somebody I want to build something with? Because that is a very difficult thing to do.
Yeah, it's super difficult. I'll tell you this story in a second, but when I met him, I had pretty much decided a week prior to that I was done looking for a co-founder. I was like, I'm done. I'm going to do this myself. I can do this. I don't need anybody. And I'm so glad that I have a co-founder. it's just so much easier, so much more fun for the highs and for the lows. But our story is kind of unique. We met through Figma. And people think that we were both designers. And while I like to dabble in design, I'm definitely not a designer. I had put out this FigJam board of all of my research on carbon markets and kind of the ecosystem and kind of all the gaps I saw. Like, these things are inefficient and that thing over there looks weird, and posed a bunch of questions. And I sent that around Twitter and a few different, you know, communities I was in, hoping that people would collaborate and contribute or call me out. I was like, this seems wrong. Like the incentives around carbon markets don't make any sense to me. Can you help me out? And everybody would look at it and kind of say, good job, Helena. Like, this is a comprehensive map. Like, actually maybe the most comprehensive I've seen. And I had to respond. I'm like, okay, that's useless. Thank you, but I would. I was like looking for like a sparring partner almost of like, call me out, right? And my co-founder, Doug, was the first to start leaving kind of comments on it. I log on one day and there's sticky notes everywhere. And they're, you know, on Fig Jam, you can like label who's written it. And it was labeled like Doug. And I was like, who is Doug? Like, why is he on my stuff? Like, I don't know a Doug. And eventually I like log on and like his cursor's there. And I'm like, ah, I caught him. I like hover over to where he is and I start like, we like messaging each other just on like sticky notes and realized this is silly. Like we should link up. And then we realized we were both in San Francisco and we met up for coffee. And again, I had pretty much just decided I wasn't looking for a co-founder, but I was like, I had to meet this guy. And the second sentence that came out of his mouth was, so are you looking for a co-founder? And I was like, this is so direct. Like, I don't know what to do with this. So we ended up like working really, really well together. And it was just happenstance that this is how it came up. But I think I had a good amount of experience in what I loved and what was frictionful in my first co-founder relationship. Not frictionful in any like negative way, more like where was there an imbalance in skill set, right? You want like a like personalities that work well together, but then also complementary skill sets in order to like maximize a partnership. And with Doug, that has been like, was true in day one and it continues to be true today. And it's very fun to kind of help each other grow professionally.
Yeah, I think that's great. I love the story, first of all. That's a really good story. I also think that something you said that may seem kind of usual to you, but I think is worth noting for people listening is the fact of finding somebody who's like a sparring partner, right? That resonates with me a lot, because finding somebody that you can build with who is going to challenge your ideas, I think is extremely important. Because if you guys are all, you know, if everybody's on the same page all the time, just like, oh yeah, we're just going to do it this way. It's like, okay, well, are you really going to build something great? Because if you're not trying to like kind of rip it apart and make it better, then you're never going to really, really be better, right? You think about some of the best founders that we think about and talk about, and they usually were really harsh people, but they were also, they really like liked somebody who could challenge them and could stand up to them because they wanted to have the best ideas, right? So I really like that a lot. I think it's fascinating. We're getting close to time. So just maybe one quick story on how, can you talk about the fundraising journey, right? Obviously you started something in the carbon markets and then kind of pivoted, but can you still talk about the major steps that you took there and any advice from that?
Yeah. I mean, don't raise when the market is crashing. No, just kidding. I think there's definitely elements of nuance. And I think the biggest one is like, as a second time founder, everything is easier. And you speak with investors in a different way. You already have a network. Doors are already, you know, warm and open. So the experience from, you know, my first company with Glimps, we went through YCE and we were like lined up to a bunch of investors who wanted to like invest in YC companies. So that helped there. And if it's your first company and you don't know anybody in the space, accelerators are a really, really good bet because they open all these doors. With Spirals and what turned into Streamline, I already knew a good amount of people. And I knew plenty of people who'd pretty much told me that like, hey, once you're ready, like, let me know, I'll be your first check. So it was a very different situation when I was starting the company. And it was more a matter of, you know, what do I want to work on? And who do I want surrounding me to help me get there? Who can I trust? Who's going to build with the same values in mind? And that's like, you know, for the super early pre-MVP, like idea stage of a fundraise. And then, you know, raising beyond that, you know, means you need to have some level of traction and conviction and a plan. But it's similar to like any other fundraising process, right? Where it's like you figure out what amount of money do you need to reach the next stage and how can you show that what you've done so far lines you up best to do that. So that's okay. That's kind of how we've run it to date. And obviously right now is probably one of the hardest times to raise in the last decade. So if you're out there trying to raise, good luck. You got this.
Yeah. I do think that for the people who have the right stuff and they have the right products, they will raise. It's just the VCs seem to be a little bit hesitant to write checks right now because of the LP market. But maybe maybe something for another time, but I would be curious if what you're proposing with the grant writing stuff could actually at some point be applied to helping VCs run more, run better kind of inbound processes, because a lot of them, it's just like opinion, right? Like they have criteria, but from a lot of the VCs we've spoken with on here, it's like, okay, there's no like hardcore, like, all right, XYZ equals we'll give you a check, right? There's some that have streamlined it a little bit more, but it's more like, oh, like we like you and we think this thing is good. There's some data behind it, but it's not super scientific, right? Except for, of course, there's some on the actual carbon reduction side that's scientific, right? But other than that, it's usually like, oh, you know, how do we feel about it? So I'd be curious for another time. But kind of to wrap up here, looking forward, what are the next big things you guys are looking towards? What does the next 6 months look like? What are you excited about?
Yeah, we're finally gonna, you know, give everybody on our waitlist access, which is so exciting. I'm so excited. But it's coming after like a wave of launches we're doing. So if you're looking at, you know, the first phase of our product, you know, there's three sections to grant writing. There's, you know, finding an opportunity, applying, and then award management once you've won the funds. We're shipping all of that in the next few months. First in, you know, beta stages, and then, you know, polishing it up. But lots of exciting kind of product launches. And with each of those, we're going to onboard more and more people. So starting to have more and more volume, which is exciting. And then starting to hire, kind of across the board. So the first kind of roles we need to fill. Right now we're a team of six and we're trying to hire like three more engineers and then bring on somebody on the policy side as well. So things are moving, things are growing. And we're pretty excited.
That's great. I'm genuinely excited to see how it goes for you guys. Because again, like I said, it's not just me saying it, but people have mentioned what you guys are doing for a few months now. So it's like, okay, everybody's waiting for this. So it'll either be really, really good or you have a lot of pressure. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So I appreciate you coming on and really looking forward to seeing where things end up in a year or so. And we'll probably have you back on at some point to talk about it.
Awesome. Let's do it. Thanks for having me.
All right. Thanks so much.